This is an interview with Bill Roach, MBE, MC, JP, Diploma of Banking from the University of New Zealand.
There will be doubtless many faults found in this talk because it disagrees with the version of this man or woman or that man or that woman. All I can say is that after referring to as much written material as is now available and my memories on the subject matter, whilst I was chair, registrar, a director, deputy chairman of directors and chairman of directors, covering a period from 1971 to the time of my retirement from the position of chairman in 1985. It is as correct as I can make it, and I can only apologise to those who disagree with it in part or in whole. The old proverb is true. Not only one man or one woman was awake in the period under review, so none can claim that their version is the only true one. In 1975, Mr. Gordon Brown wrote a very full account calling on how it all began, plus additional writings concerning the activities of the Corp. When Gordon stated that the honour of being the founding father of the Corp was Mr. Ian McLeod, in his opening speech at the first meeting held in the McLeod home, Ian said, "We had to be loyal of cooperation and staunch in whatever activities the Corp undertook." In September 1935, when the membership was 200, a general meeting was held and the first grocery was opened in Broadway, Palmers North, on the 14th of November 1935. I do not intend subjecting you to a step-by-step account of the early growth of the Corp, but go straight to the time Gordon Brown became general manager in 1949, which post he held until his retirement in 1973, when he was also made an advisory director. It is sometimes asked who was assigned shareholder number one. Gordon, in his wisdom, assigned the numbers 1 to 3 to a staff pension fund and two other funds set up for staff benefits. Gordon was assigned shareholder number 4. In this talk, I propose bringing out some of the happenings which are unrecorded. Gordon told me that in the early meetings, the method of electing the management committee was a rather blunt and rough method on the candidates, who were lined up against the wall and the voters sized them up from there. Gordon also told me, compared to this method of voting, that at a general meeting of the Granity Co-op in the west coast of the South Island, where the membership was predominantly coal miners, the Palmers North meeting were rather tame affairs. When the Co-op was first started, the membership fee was £1. £2 was paid on submitting the application, and the balance spread over the following 12 months, with any balance still owned at the time of the rebate was declared and taken out of the rebate earned by the shareholder. One of the biggest groups of the new members were the staff of the New Zealand Railways, and when Gordon Brown was really scratching for some cash, he would get on his bike and ride down to the locomotive sheds then situated in the West Street, arriving there on paydays. At first, Gordon Brown was honorary secretary, which position was taken over by Horsfall, who later worked for another business. In Palmers North, but subsequently returned to as secretary of the Corp, which position he just retired from in 1973. At this point, I propose giving a thumbnail sketch of some of the directors known to me, be it very slightly in the case of Duncan McCall. Gordon was managing secretary from 1941 to 49, general manager 49 to 72, and advisory director in 1973. Was elected to the board in 1979 and subsequently elected chairman, which position he occupied until he died in 1982. I can truthfully state that his salary as general manager was a real pittance, considering his business skills and the work effort in building up the Co-op. His retirement payment was also a relatively small amount. Gordon Brown did not make any money out of the Co-op.
Everyone acknowledged Gordon Brown made the Corp a success. Whilst on the matter of directors, I propose at this junction to make some well-deserved mention of a few of them. Gordon Brown told me that Duncan McCall was a very progressive chairman who pursued with his board a very active policy of opening additional groceries. Duncan was a sound businessman. On the death of Duncan McCall in 1972, Mr. Mick Murphy took over as chairman, having been elected to the board in 1960. After a period of being deputy chairman for a number of years, became chairman in 1972. I knew Mick very well. Mick was a deep-thinking, sound businessman, and he did his homework on corp matters, which required his thorough attention. Mick was a kindly disposed to all matters concerning the welfare of the staff. Well, I must also mention Mrs. Muriel McDonough, who was a chairman for 26 years, 1952 to 1978. From reports, Muriel was an excellent director and also did her homework on corp matters very well and thoroughly. And from the odd remark from senior executive, I gleaned that Muriel had a very inquiring mind, which gave good result to board decisions. Last but not least, I must make mention of Mr. Gordon Brown, whose personal drive, outstanding skills and dedication to the cause of the cooperative movement in Palmerston North and surrounding districts is well known. He can be given the highest credit for the growth of the local Consumers Cooperative Society. He was Honorary Secretary in 1935, Managing Secretary in 1941-49, General Manager 1949-1973, and on his retirement was made an Advisory Director, which position he held.
In 1979, he was elected to the board, and in 1981 became Chairman. Unfortunately, in 1982, Gordon died from a heart complaint, brought on, no doubt, from the many years of business stress and very long hours of work for the Corp, and at the same time, he made time to be a city councillor and also heavily involved in rugby union, rugby football activities, both on a local level and was for a term chairman of New Zealand Rugby Football Union. During all of these activities, he was ably assisted by his wife, Marge Brown. When the first Corp started, the membership fee was £1, 2 shillings and sixpence on submitting the application, with a balance spread over the following 12 months. One of the biggest groups of shareholders came from the New Zealand Railways, and when Gordon was really scratching for money to purchase stocks for the shop, he would get on his bike and ride down to the locomotive sheds in West Street, arriving there on payday. The Corp was registered under the Friendly Societies Act, which gave the Corp advantage in regards to payment of tax, in that it did not have to pay tax on any rebates paid to its members within 3 months of its annual balance date. Despite this advantage, the Corp still paid very large amounts of tax in subsequent years. Gordon Brown set up a loan capital system under which members could invest their surplus money with the Co-op, and this money was very important in the development of the Co-op, even though the system had its weaknesses in that the money invested was repayable on demand. The Corp was registered under the Friendly Societies Act, which spelt out very clearly when the Corp was registered that the additional money invested with the Corp had to be by way of shares. Gordon ran into real problem in an illegal way. He wanted his loan capital system operated just like a money savings account in the post office. Gordon discussed his problem with a then local Member of Parliament, who quietly had a small amendment made to the Friendly Societies Act in order to put the Corp loan capital system on the right side of the law. Considering that the two parties were on different sides of the political fence, it did show great understanding by the then Member of Parliament for the local
city of Palmerston North, the problems to overcome in assisting the ordinary New Zealander who made up the major portion of the workforce and whose wages in those days were very minimum. In the early days of the history of the co-op, there was hostility to the co-op in many corners of the marketplace when seeking wholesale supplies. The boycott was skillfully used, and there's no doubt its purpose was to smash the co-op in its infancy.
Can you tell me more about that boycott?
Well, you know, I mean, if you cut it off, yeah. The boycott was this way. All right, he'd want supplies of, say, sugar, mm-hmm. Or supplies of biscuits. So many gross of this, you see. I'm afraid we could only supply you with a quarter of that supply, You see. That's how it was done, you see. He didn't get a full, as I understood it, or they had no stock, get me? All their stock was, especially when it came wartime, you know what I mean, that when stocks were rationed out, you know what I mean, all right, they were at the bottom of the heap, the corp was at the bottom of the heap, the other chaps got the first pick. But you understand that in wartime there was rationing.
Yes, yes.
And it was very skillfully used in that way. That's the way, he never actually spelt it out the way it was done, but that's Gordon's own writing. It was very skillfully done, you see.
Yes.
If you read that thing of which Ian's got, I'm not talking this now, is it? Oh. For this reason, the Gordon Brown never sought membership of the local Chamber of Commerce. Eventually, the Corp had approximately 27 shops and in some cases butchers attached. The shops were spread around Palmerston North, plus stores at Tohappy, Bulls, Ashurst, Piatur, Levin, Foxton and Fielding. Written evidence of currently available shows that in 1983 there were 32,295 shareholders, of which 20,705 were resident in the city of Palmerston North. In the main, the original merchant manufacturer's trouble had been overcome, and the co-op achieved an unenviable growth culminating in the purchase of the Premier Drapery Company in 1956. This was a great step forward along the path of progress. Gordon Brown told me that at the time of the purchase, a certain prominent public accountant remarked to Gordon that the co-op in its PDC operations would not be able to pay the trade accounts each month when they were due. I knew in my time with the co-op, with Gordon as general manager, woe bestow any department which had an account rendered. Gordon took pride that all trade accounts were paid on due date, and this fact assisted in the obtaining of the supply of goods. By 1960, the co-op had become a big business by New Zealand standards. Revitalising the PDC, enlargement of premises became an urgent necessity. This was solved by a combination of new buildings and the purchase of Pegden's and the Power Board buildings, which adjoined the PDC building. Strangely enough, there were shareholders who thought the co-op was getting too big and said so. The hazards that may erode from giant-sized business, co-op or otherwise, stem not from size but from complacency. During my time as share registrar, I saw the number of shareholders grow to about 34,000, which called for the need for accounting to be done by computers, which was effected on a contract basis with Data Bank. The use of computers made it possible for the up-to-date reports to be produced speedily and regularly, very important information for the board and management. In July 1982, the government interest on deposit regulations came into operation. The co-op was not affected by this order as it was a trading organisation. As a result of this order, the Corp had a real ball in building up a total of loan capital. What was not required in the operation of the Corp was invested with banks, secured mortgages, etc. And in 1 year, this reinvestment earned approximately $1 million in interest. Mick Murphy and myself inspected all the landed property securities, and that meant visiting various places in the North Island and once to Christchurch. All the security documents were held under the custody of the share registrar, who was also responsible for the correctness of the valid securities in accordance with the terms of the loan approval. The real strength of the loan capital system came from the advantages that it gave the merchandising staff in their scale of their purchases, and they were frequently able to make scoop purchases. I must add that certain members in the management team, merchandising team, were frequently able to make substantially scoop purchases with no worry where the money was going to come from to make payment for their purchases. These real deals were very favourable to the Co-op. It was in 1983 that Mick Murphy, as chairman, stated in his annual report that the Co-op was embarrassed with its riches. From written records during the period 1977 to 82, the Co-op paid out a total of $6,577,000 in interest and $6,697,000 in rebates, making a total of $30,274,353, which the Co-op put back into the local economy. During 1 year, the share office was accounting for a total loan capital of about $20 million, and from the interest on the money not required in running the business, there was a return of about $1 million. Not a bad return from a staff of nine who had to run the rebate system, enrolment of new shareholders, and maintaining all necessary records. However, there were two forms of investment in loan capital. One was on core basis and another by debentures for varying periods, carrying a higher rate of interest than that on core loan capital. Most of the investors, in terms of numbers and total amounts, were women. And at one time, we had to restrict the new money we would receive because the money total was becoming a bit embarrassing. This loan capital system provided a plentiful supply of easy and cheap finance, and there were some hidden dangers inherent in such a system. And to protect the Co-op, the board laid down a policy of what percentage of loan capital had to be invested in readily available locations. For instance, we were holding at least $3 million on term deposit with the trading banks, and the Co-op had other easily negotiable securities plus an overdraft arrangement with its bankers. I now touch on some dangers inherent in the call system of financing and the problems which were encountered during my term as share office. When the JBL Joint Venture Property Ownership Scheme came under scrutiny by the financial observers, there was a slight run of more than normal withdrawals from the loan capital scheme. Gordon Brown was general manager at the time and showed some sensible concern. As an ex-banker, I did not worry. Then when Security Bank, another financing group, got into real trouble by not having sufficient on-call money available to meet its financial commitments, was a rub-off on the Co-op, and there was a substantial draw on the loan capital, which the Co-op met easily. The whole play was a ready check for the amount required to be withdrawn, plus a smile from the staff and no outward signs of concern. Shortly the dust settled, and the loan capital started to mount up again, and a system of term deposits was introduced. Things in connection with loan capital system went along smoothly until the Public Service and Investment Society ran into financial trouble by their large investment in a Wellington property. There were serious ramifications on our loan capital system in that particular time, and there was a substantial and continued reduction on the amount held in loan capital. The atmosphere for the Corp was not helped by the very wide coverage of the problems which the public service were encountering, and the news items on the television did not assist either. As a share register, I had to meet the loan capital holders up front, which I did with a ready smile, an air of confidence, and a ready cheque for the amount required to be withdrawn. You must be mindful that some shareholders were holding fairly large amounts in loan capital. The problems with the Public Service Investment Society soon went away when the government appointed the statutory manager, who eventually put that society on a sound position financially. In all, it was a matter of confidence. The COP had substantial cash reserves and we rode out the storm. I was share registrar when Gordon Brown asked me to investigate the matter of a trustee for the Co-op to place an additional protection for the investors in loan capital. It was a protection deed outside the human protection given by senior management and finally the board of directors. Gordon wanted a built-in restriction on the amount the board could borrow outside the loan capital system, plus certain other safeguards, such as a system of reporting to the trustees named in the deed, which had the power to declare certain decisions made by the board null and void. You must realise that the trustees had a very important duty. It is usual for big organisations handling investments monies to have a trustee, and in fact is mandatory in most cases. First trustees were Mr. Felix Morrow, one of the auditors for the Corp, and to whom the Corp is heavily indebted for his duties carried out. Other one was Tim Luffnam, the Corp solicitor. When Tim died, Joe Walding was asked to replace him, which Joe did willingly. Now, there's one very important matter I want to draw your attention to about being a trustee under a deed to be signed by the Corp. The matter is, if a trustee is found to have failed in his absolute duty as a trustee under the wordings, or otherwise under implied duties as a trustee, his personal estate could be subject to seizure, either partly or in whole. When the unexpected and Joe Walding died, the board was faced with the task of finding a replacement trustee. It had no success because of the public liability factor. As I had had previous dealings with the New Zealand Insurance Company on matters of trusts, I approached this company, which owned the New Zealand Guardian Trust Company, which was a trustee for many large businesses whose shares were listed on the stock exchange, and borrowed money from the public in other forms. Initially, the board of directors of the Guardian Trust was not in favour of taking the Corp as one of its clients. However, the chairman of the Guardian Trust pointed out, despite some dangers in our being their client, here was over 32,000 New Zealanders in a consumers corp in a country district who were in desperate need for the service of the Guardian Trust. Through the influence of the chairman of the Guardian Trust, who must have known Gordon Brown personally, the Guardian Trust agreed to accept our business. The Corp would have been in real trouble if it had been unable to secure a replacement trustee. The chairman of the Guardian Trust, I may add, His ancestors came from a certain independent state in the Middle East. The guardian trust required a fresh deed of trust, a deed prepared and then approved by their solicitors. On the 27th of August 1979, the Securities Act was considered by Parliament and was published. When that bill came in, an Act of Parliament, we had to become prepared to meet the requirements of the Act to operate our loan capital system. We were not set up to meet the requirements of the law, which became operative in a few months' time. And if we had not been able to do so, we would have had to close our loan capital operation. With the authority of the board, I entered into discussions with Mr. Colin Patterson, the Security Commissioner, to whom I was not unknown. Mr. Patterson advised me that as far as he knew, the Consumers Corp Society Manawatu Limited was then the only friendly society with a properly prepared trust deed. Mr. Patterson was also impressed with our accounting and other procedures associated with the operations of the loan capital. I had to spend some time with his staff, who were not as generous with their understanding as Mr. Patterson, who was a straight down the line Scot. Prior to his appointment as the Security Commissioner, Mr. Patterson was one of the senior partners of a highly respected large legal firm in Wellington, who also had one of their partners, a very smart lawyer who had recently been employed by the government law drafting department. The scene then was this. In a matter of weeks, when the Act became law, and after our Wellington solicitors we chose being the legal firm above mentioned, the document had to be submitted to the legal advisors for Guardian Trust. And believe me, that was a long and exacting task. Security commissioners gave us two very necessary extensions of 3 months to meet the law requirements. We breathed again to operate the loan capital system. During 1980, the co-op entered into an arrangement with Foodstuffs Wellington Limited, under which the co-op obtained its grocery goods from Foodstuffs, who supplied many own-operated business in Palmers North and the surrounding country towns. This policy did away with the need to operate the co-op bulk store for food lines. This store was situated on the Tremaine Avenue, Palmers North. In addition, Foodstuffs supplied the co-op with their marketing skills, and under this operation, the no-frills selling of groceries, etc., was set up in the Isadium building in Palmerston North. The area for our meat preparation adjoined the Isadium. The prices were discounted to be competitive, and we also asked Foodstuffs assistance in getting our PDC food hall operated in an efficient manner and also make for better presentation of its products for sale. For various reasons, the marriage with Foodstuffs did not work out as originally had been hoped. On the 21st of June 1982, a circular letter signed by Gordon as chairman and Arthur Bartlett as general manager was sent to all shareholders, advising that in the past 2 years, discounting had sharply reduced the profits from food to the extent that the 5% rebate on food had been maintained only by a subsidy from the more profitable non-food divisions. Consequently, the rebate on food was to cease. Today, in 1992, a rebate of 5%, as was paid by the Corp, would not be accepted when discounts of up to 15% offered in many instances by a number of retailers. 1982, Mr. Brown died, which was most unexpected, and was met with great sorrow among the very wide range of people, both locally and on a national scale. Then in September 1983, as a result of some papers falling off the back of a truck, the COP sought an injunction in the High Court to restrain the Palmerston North City Council from proceeding with the sale of certain lands it owned in Palmerston North adjacent to the square to a company called Progressive Enterprises, or its subsidiaries, which happened to, in this case, to be Foodtown Supermarket Limited. At this point, I want to recall two important happenings which give the reason why the Corp did not work in closer with foodstuffs in the Corp move to get out of food trading. In response to my inquiry to the Managing Director of Foodstuffs, there was no financial assistance that could be expected from foodstuffs for a part of the legal costs associated with the court action against Foodtown. Also, Foodstuffs had previously investigated the impossibility of building a supermarket on land adjacent to and including the old Maryland factory with entrance ways from Ferguson Street to Fitzherbert Avenue. They would have... you're right.
Yeah.
They had not told the Corp of their proposals to set up shop not far distant from the new PDC food hall in which the Corp had invested a considerable amount of money. To cut a long story short, the Corp was granted an interim injunction, which was subsequently reversed, and then the Corp went to the Court of Appeal, which granted the Corp an interim injunction. Because of the legal costs involved, and what more, the Corp did not really want to stand in the way of progress in the city by buying more land for which it did not have an immediate use. The Corp decided not to go back to the High Court for judgment, which would have put back Foodtown only a few months in starting up their building. At this point, I want to recall an interesting bit of information concerning the land fronting Linton Street, owned by the City Council and sold to Foodtown. In the middle of the City Council block, there was 1 square metre of land for which there was no land title. And in fact, the City Council did not own it. It was the result of a survey error, and this square metre of land was in law owned by several beneficiaries of various states who had owned the land purchased by the City Council. The Corp knew if we could have, without prior knowledge to the Council, purchased this square metre of land, being a thorn in the side of Foodtown. The eventual purchase of that square metre would make it the dearest bit of real estate ever sold in Palmer North. Price rival the prices paid in Tokyo, Japan for business real estate. Bill Roach then saw the mayor, Mr. Brian Wellwood, to advise him that the Corp did not want to present itself as an organisation that stood in the way of development of the city. During the discussion with Mr. Elwood, he advised Bill Roach that the Waddy's Industries, who owned Protect Engineering, situated on the old Berry Engineering site on the corner of Ferguson Street and Ashley Street, was up for sale as Protect were building new premises in the railway road. The next day, the mayor furnished Bill with a copy of the property land plan. Bill Roach was immediately interested because, as Mark Twain said, they don't make land anymore. Bill could see that in time, the land would be of future value to the Corp, because of its proximity to the PDC. The building did not present a very pretty sight, but Bill was not interested in the buildings, but in the eventual use of the land. Bill is of the opinion that the purchase of the Protect property was really the start of all the development around the PDC, which was to follow. Today, September 1992, there is Foodtown Supermarket, the Plaza, Kmart, remodeled Isadian building with the adjoining remodeled old butchery preparation room, and the liquor store, which had previously sold to Wilson and Neal. The old Majestic Hotel, which was also owned by the Corp, has been demolished. The land previously owned by Burgess Hardware, situated between the liquor store and the Zodium, provided a good entranceway from Fitzherbert Avenue to the large car park and gave ready entranceway for firefighting purposes, a very important matter which had to be taken into account. The project property was purchased for $709,000, which was below the government valuation. The Corp sold half the land to the Food Town for $500,000, who also made a substantial contribution to the development of the car park. Unfortunately for the Corp, the City Council weren't as generous in dealing with the, and the Corp had to pay the City Council a fairly large sum of money to incorporate this area of land in the car park. The purchase of the project property gave the Corp just on 10 acres of land bordered by the Square, Ashley Street, Ferguson Street and Fitzherbert Avenue. That was after we had purchased Smith and Walling's depot, Direct Fish Supply property and Burgess Hardware. Sometime during August 1984, the general manager advised me that the trading results of the food division for the financial year ending 30th of June 1984 were again very bad, with a loss of about $500,000, after a loss of about a similar amount the previous year. Arthur Bartlett, the general manager, stated he should tender his resignation as general manager. He said that with Food Town opening up on the site facing Linton Street, the position of the Co-op food division was hopeless as to its future existence. Food Town was the real success story in New Zealand when it came to selling foodstuffs. In my day, especially on the top of Hell Path Pass in the Western Desert on the boundary between Egypt and Libya in 1942, I had to make a quick decision in about 5 seconds on a very important attack plan, which was successful. In my reply to the general manager, I said, I'm going to invite Food Town to build their supermarket on the region of the PDC. The general manager thought my decision was ridiculous, as our relations with Food Town were not exactly cordial, having regard to our recent court action against the City Council, which upset Food Town plans by about 12 months, and the big boys in business do not like being upset. The general manager rightly pointed out that I did not have authority of the board to make any important approach with Food Town. The general manager and I went to Auckland the following day to approach Food Town with the proposition. The reception from Mr. Bell, their property manager, was not exactly warm, which is understandable. After explaining our proposal to him, Mr. Bell asked to be excused to consult somewhere else in his organisation. We were given to understand it was his chairman of directors. Whilst Mr. Bell was absent, I told Arthur Bartlett that our prospects were bright. He didn't think we had a bolter show when we first went to Auckland. I'd had a long experience as a bank manager in judging the reaction of business proposition, and I felt pretty sure on this case. I found out later that whilst Mr. Bell was absent from us, he told his assistant to hold everything in connection with the proposed development of their Linton Street property, as he now had the prospects of a far better site for their supermarket. It's great what a few ground plans, a large-scale area map of the properties around the PDC did. I must remind all at this point that I had to purchase other properties required to complete any deal. It was arranged that as soon as possible we would meet in Wellington Mr. Bell and Mr. Jack Teese, Food Town architect and property developer. This meeting drew favourable comments from Mr. Teese, and he was to have a look at the properties as soon as possible, as Food Town had arranged with Mr. Ron Oakey to sign a contract within 9 days for the erection of their supermarket in Linton Street.
I realised that I still had to obtain the Corp board approval to the whole deal and authority to negotiate for the required additional properties and accessways to a car park sufficient to take 650 cars. I must at this point say that I appreciated very much the confidence the board gave me in my proposals, but all realised that much more had to be done. It was a case of just being confident in one's own judgment of the whole future of the co-op, getting out of trading in food and concentrating in its PGC operations.
There was a big philosophical shift then.
Yeah. It was absolutely necessary for the strictest of secrecy about the proposal with Foodtown. The board members were told plainly that if there was a leak of information, then such a happening could only have come from one of the board members or the general manager. All reports were handwritten by the general manager. I will now deal separately with the purchase of the various properties, all of which we had to have. The Smith and Balding Depot was owned by the estate of the late Charles Walding. Joe Walding was one of the trustees. I spoke to Joe in the PDC car park about the Corp wanting to buy the property owned by his late brother's estate, of which Joe was one of the two trustees. I told Joe that the Corp had purchased the Protect property and the Corp wanted his depot property to get access to the PDC car park. Joe replied that he did not want to know what the Corp was planning to do, but he stated, "Whatever you do, Bill, the Corp should do it properly and big enough, because Palmers North was going to be here in 200 years hence." Yeah. End of quote. As part of the deal, the Corp had to find his company suitable replacement premises on a rental basis for the requirements of Smith and Walding Limited, which company was a large-scale catering business. The Corp had already such a place to move into, because the meat preparation set up on the corner of Fitzherbert Avenue and Ferguson Street was not now being used. Then came the very delicate negotiations to buy the fish depot and fish and chip shop, owned by Direct Fish Suppliers of Napier. We did not know at the time that they were willing sellers, and the owners of the Direct Fish Company was a very and the owner of the Direct Fish Company was a very old and close friend of Gordon Brown. Nevertheless, the general manager did not know this information when he made his first moves to purchase the property. The Corp was keen to enter into possession as soon as possible after the signing of the necessary legal papers. But for some unknown reason, the Napier firm of solicitors acting for the vendor company was not prepared to accept the settlement monies before the final due date. I was not at all happy with the actions of the vendor solicitors. Consequently, I instructed the Corp solicitors to forthwith place a caveat on the title to protect the Corp's interest.
So what did that mean, placing a caveat? No, I need to know.
Oh, I did not want any hold-ups on the plans of purchasing. In other words, the caveat stopped anybody else dealing with the property without us knowing it. And by this time, there was a rumour that the Corp intended building a large luxury hotel on the Protect site. My next proposition to the board was to purchase Burgess Hardware property, who were not willing sellers in the first instance because the company had recently upgraded this plant and wanted to get some use out of it. The Corp board in the first instance threw out the proposal to purchase the property, put to them mainly because of the majority thought the property was not necessary with the plan to have the food tent on the site, which deal the Corp was to provide 650 car parks.
However, I had a special meeting called to reconsider the matter of a purchase of this property and pointed out that once the news broke that Foodtown were coming onto the site, the asking price would soar. The board then agreed to buy the Burgess property. And then I knew that the co-op was in a safe position to prepare with the preparation of the heads of agreement document with Foodtown. Foodtown came up with a plaza development to complement their food retailing operation. This development was not contemplated when the co-op first put the proposition to Foodtown to put their supermarket next to the PDC. However, management sat down with the board and did its sums on all the projected capital expenditure of the development around the PDC and what the co-op could expect to obtain from the sale of all properties associated with the food division, plus the sale of a large bulk store in Tremaine Avenue, part of which was used by the PDC. In effect, the co-op was swapping the monies tied up in the food division for the landed assets around the PDC site. A replacement depot was purchased for PDC purposes in Tainui Street. Management and the board then calculated the balance of any money required over and above what would be required from the sale of the what could be received from the sale of the unwanted properties. It must be appreciated that all the sales were not done at the same time, and during this time lag, the need to keep a good amount of ready cash on hand had to be provided for. The interest rate current then was relatively low, 7%, compared with the very high rates which increased substantially when the government opened up a free market of Rogernomics, which made forward planning most difficult. The Corp had to make up its mind very quickly if, with all the required properties now around the PDC, it was prepared to finalise Was it prepared to finalise a deal with Foodtown, taking into account the extra spending required on the suggested plaza, the refurbishing and updating of the PDC had also to be contemplated for attention at the same time. On the 20th of November 1984, Bill Roach, as chairman, held a press conference in company with Foodtown Finance and Administration Director, Mr. Warrie Holmes, when Bill advised that the Co-op Food Division continued to run at a loss, in fact, a total of about $1 million during the past 2 years, a performance which could only be compounded with the arrival of Foodtown on the local retailing operations. He said that the Co-op was getting out of one market where the Co-op profitability was in question and concentrating the Co-op resources where the Co-op was a history of success. That is the PDC store together with the motorbike shop and the petrol station. In the redevelopment, the Co-op was to provide 650 car parks, and the Foodtown representative stated that their supermarket would be their biggest and would be their model for future stores. The completion of the document heads of agreement with Foodtown resulted in very protracted discussions, with Foodtown wanting everything their way. In the main, such a document put into the print the main items of the deal, which are to be done, who pays for what, and what other agreements are to be completed. For example, as Foodtown would not require the Linton Street property they had purchased from the City Council and the adjoining owners, the Co-op was to purchase this property from Foodtown. At one of the meetings of the directors, one of our directors mentioned the name Woolworths, been interested in the co-op site that resulted in Foodtown starting to make softer, to making a softer stance on the discussions, in the discussions. There were some very nitty-gritty discussions with representatives from Foodtown and their property developer. Foodtown often had their legal advisor with them. Eventually, the position was reached where a meeting of the co-op chairman and the general manager and Mr. Bell, Foodtown property manager, who had with him his legal advisor to handle the negotiation. The co-op engaged a specialist lawyer to protect the co-op's interest in questions of law and interpretations in the heads of agreement document. The meeting was held at the office of the solicitors we had engaged to prepare our trust deed in Wellington. This meeting was a prolonged affair. Many points were thrashed out, and Bill Roach would not agree to Foodtown's request that there be a restriction on the height of any new buildings which may in the future be erected on land at the rear of the PDC. Obviously, Foodtown did not want their supermarket hedged in with high-rise buildings. When the heads of agreement document arrived in Palms North the following day, Bill Roach examined the document very closely because he was fearful that the question of future building heights could have been hidden in some long-winded clause and tucked in with other legal jargon. The fears that Bill Roach had about the matter of heights of future buildings were correct. When he inspected the document, he noticed that a clause had been inserted putting this restriction on. Bill Roach considered this insertion of the restriction clause a complete breach of faith by Foodtown and refused permission of the co-op signing the document, advised Foodtown accordingly by a letter. At that point, Bill nearly pulled the plug on the whole negotiations. Mr. Bell of Foodtown quickly realised he had been caught out, and thereafter Foodtown approach in the whole business was more helpful. Among the comments Mr. Brian Elwood, the mayor, made at the time of the press conference was the development would create a very exciting shopping complex up to international standards, and the consumer would benefit from the development. Nowhere else in the city is there this amount of land able to be consolidated in terms of having a real complex with a huge car park. After completing the legal formalities, then came the real action to get the project underway, and Arthur Butler, the general manager, was an exceedingly busy executive. It was also decided to refurbish the PDC retail area and make some rearrangements in the buildings at the same time. As the plaza was to be erected on the old club hotel site on which the PDC food hall had already been erected, it is very easy to cover these happenings by a few lines of script, but it must be recorded that the board and the executive and the senior staff worked very hard to make the project a reality. After being re-elected in 1985, Bill Roach resigned from the board on the strongest possible advice from his specialist doctor. Bill Roach, they said, the various executives and their staff gave of their best in the interest of the corp and made valuable contributions, particularly in their special fields of knowledge. New Zealand is noted for having a great number of knockers among this population. Amongst the corp shareholders, there was a number of knockers as to what the corp should have done to keep the society alive. The shareholders themselves were a great number of cases found lacking in their loyalty by not trading with the co-op retail outlets as much as they could have. This lack of loyalty also happened in Australia, where the large consumers co-op in Newcastle, New South Wales, with a membership of 65,000, had stopped trading because of losing the loyalty of its members, and their much-renowned store renowned store finished up in the dead end of the city, with the big public companies finally pushing the Australian cooperative out of trading. Gordon Brown was shocked when he found out what had happened to this organisation, which he had held in very high esteem. Nobody could have foreseen the sudden drop and continued decline in retail spending, which came about whilst the co-op development was underway, when the owners operated specialty shops, when the owner-operated specialty shops continued to grow in number. In recent years, the New Zealand has seen the closure of several large departmental stores which could not compete in the matter of operating costs against the owner-operated and smaller specialty shops. Nobody could have foreseen the constant upward spiral in interest rates that had to be paid on borrowed money. The co-op, with its very small share capital base, was wide open to attack on this front. When the loyalty of the corp was a decreasing factor in their trading. Bill Roach poses the question, would there have been a huge modern retail selling complex accompanied by additional office rental in modern buildings together with large ground level car parking adjoining these developments, had it not been for the courage and foresight of the Consumers Cooperative Society, Manitou Limited? Bill Roach now hands over the balance of this information to Barry Parker, who was chairman of the board following his retirement. This address was given by Bill Roach in September 1992. Okay. Is it going?
Yeah.